morning. It's good to be with you today. Great to have a lot of visitors with us. We're very glad that you're here. Hope the things that we say and do here, you'll find that they are pleasing to God and that they will be an encouragement to you. I want to talk this morning about denying self. In Luke chapter 9, verse 23, Jesus said, "If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world and is himself destroyed or lost?" So Jesus clearly says that we need to deny ourselves. And so we need to understand what that is. And I believe that there are three attitudes that we can have toward ourselves. First attitude that people can have toward themselves is they can have no confidence. Sometimes we call this the grasshopper complex based on what we see in the Israelites when they went to spy out. The 12 spies went to spy out the land, and 10 spies came back and gave an unfavorable report and said, "We're like grasshoppers in their sight, so are we in our sight, so are we in their sight." So the problem was is that they had this lack of self-esteem and really a lack of confidence because they had misplaced faith. They did not place their faith in God. Sometimes people have that kind of attitude about themselves. They have such an inferiority complex and such a sad outlook on things that they cease to even have the desire to try to do anything. And another attitude that people may have when it comes to self is they may have too much confidence. They have conceit. And they're arrogant, and many times that attitude results in strife in their families and with their relationships. Proverbs chapter 3, verse 10 says, "By pride comes only contention, but with the well-advised is wisdom." So strife comes many times with the attitude of arrogance and too much confidence. And many times it leads people to trust in their own ways instead of God's ways, and certainly pride is talked about many times in Proverbs, also in chapter 16, verse 18. Pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. When you start thinking too highly of yourself, then there are problems. But the attitude that we should have toward ourselves is a proper love or a self-respect that is found in the right avenues. That proper love that we can have because of God loving us and we recognizing our own limitations, but we can know that God gave His Son for us, and so that gives us the attitude that God loved us, and we have self-respect. We also want to talk about what is discipleship, because Jesus says His disciples need to take up their cross and follow Him, and to deny themselves. So what is discipleship? Let's look in Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9, as we've already seen, he says that if you desire to come after me, deny yourself. And there's three steps that you'll notice here in chapter 9 of Luke. Three different steps you need to deny, and you need to take, and you need to follow. You deny yourself, you take up the cross, and you follow after Christ. So there's three things. And sometimes people don't want to do one or more of these things. First of all, some won't become a Christian or live successfully as a Christian because they won't deny themselves. One of the first things that we need to do to become a Christian is to repent. And repenting means that we need to turn away from sin. And so if I have the attitude, well, you know, I really feel this way. I know that this is what God says, but this is the way that I feel. Or I know you're telling me that God says this, but I've always believed something else. Or if I've always thought something else, listen to what I have to say about that. Well, that's not denying yourself. You know, that's putting yourself in first place. So some will not become Christians because they won't do that. They won't deny themselves. And sometimes Christians won't grow for some of the same reasons, because of self-centeredness, that things always have to be our way. And sometimes when things have to be our way because we're self-centered, it makes for hurt feelings. That we wear our feelings on our sleeve, and just the slightest comment or slightest perceived offense can set somebody set somebody off or make them to be unfaithful to God because they feel like their brethren have been mean to them. Because this self-centeredness often makes us, you know, too touchy. Philippians chapter 2, verses 5 through 8. Philippians chapter 2, verses 5 through 8. Paul says, "Let this mind be in you which was in Christ Jesus, who, being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking on the form of a bondservant and coming in the likeness of men. And being found in the appearance of a man, he humbled himself and became obedient even to the point of death." Even the death of the cross. So when Paul says he made himself, Christ made himself of no reputation, it means that he emptied himself. He made himself nothing. And how willing are we really to do that, to be a disciple? He did what was best for others and not himself. And so I believe we see what the standard is. Paul tells us what the standard is that we need to be like Christ. We need to empty ourselves. We don't need to be self-centered. But how do we do that? How can we not be self-centered? We need to recognize, first of all, the problem. We need to recognize that there is a problem, and we need to try to make Christ our example. Pride in the New Testament is always used in the evil sense. And I know that many times we use the word pride. We talk about pride of ownership, you know, when you have a nice car. You talk about taking pride in your work, that you want, you know, do your work so that you'd want to sign your name to it. And sometimes you see the tags. You know, I think for all you old folks, you remember Inspector 12 on some of those commercials. You know, that there is somebody that is doing that. There's some Inspector 12 somewhere that's taking pride in that garment or whatever it is that's being made. Do it so that you want to sign your name to it. We talk about pride in such a good way today. But really, the word pride in the Bible is not perceived in a good way, because pride is defined as showing oneself above others, and often to the point of being the one that's preeminent and being arrogant or haughty or disdainful of others. That's Vine's definition of the word pride in the New Testament. And we see that embodied in the Scriptures, also in Proverbs chapter 6. The six things that the Lord hates, yea, seven, are an abomination to Him: a proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift in running to evil, a false witness that speaks lies, and one who sows discord among the brethren. Certainly, those things are all evil, and it's not insignificant that it starts out with saying a proud look is one of the things that the Lord hates. Also in Romans chapter 12, in verse 3, Paul warns the brethren. He says, "Though through the grace given to me, I say to everyone who is among you not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith." So think soberly. Don't think too highly of yourself. And you know, it's an attribute of being a child sometimes when we see people don't want to share. And if people don't get their way, you know, sometimes, you know, the expression is, "I'm just going to take my toys and go home." And, you know, it's not just an expression. Sometimes you see that happen. You know, if the person who's in control of the toys doesn't get their way, "Well, I'm just going to, if you don't like playing according to my rules, or you don't do what I want you to do, I'm just going to take everything and I'm going to go home." And sometimes that happens. Or sometimes everybody else says, "No, we'll do it your way because we don't want you to take your toys and go away." And we see that as people get older sometimes. You know, one of the things that separates really good basketball players from great ones is the ones that aren't ball hogs. And the ones that that have a lot of skill personally and won't share the glory with somebody else have a real hard time being on a team. You know, "If I can't pitch, I'm not going to play," is attitude. So it's really childish to have that kind of attitude. But when it comes to spiritual matters, certainly people have that same kind of childish attitude from time to time. In Mark chapter 10, as was read this morning, Mark chapter 10, Jesus talks about the the fact that the disciples really didn't understand what it was that Jesus was coming to do, because they asked, "Let us sit on your right hand and on your left hand." Jesus said, "Are you able to do what it is that I'm going to do? Are you able to drink the cup that I'm about to drink?" And they said, "We are able." And Jesus told them that they're really not able to do that. And when the other disciples heard about it, they were greatly displeased with James and John. Probably not because of the fact that they knew that that was an inappropriate question to ask, but because they also wanted to be on the right hand and on the left as well, and they got first dibs at it, and they were angry. But Jesus called them to Himself and said, "You know that those who are considered rulers over the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you. Whoever desires to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever of you desires to be first shall be slave of all." So the first will be last, and the last will be first. The ones who want the chief seat, the ones that want to have that place of authority to be recognized, Jesus said, that's really not the question you should be asking. So the problem of self is really based upon this mountain of pride and self-righteousness many times that the people have. And certainly self-righteousness and pride is the characteristic of what we see in the Pharisees and what Jesus condemned about the attitude of the Pharisees. In Luke chapter 18 and verse 9, it starts out by saying that Jesus told this parable for a specific reason. It says that He spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves, that they were righteous and despised others. So here He's addressing this to those who think too highly of themselves, and not only do they think highly of themselves, but they don't think much of anybody else. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, "God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector. I fast twice a week, I give tithes of all that I possess." And the tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted." The point certainly could not have been lost upon those who were listening to that. It's very clear what Jesus is saying. It's very clear that the Pharisee thought very highly of himself and presented his prayer like a resume to God of, "Here's why you should be impressed with me, and aren't you lucky that I'm praying to you?" And the tax collector recognized who he was, and Jesus said that he was the one that was in the right relationship with God. Sometimes Pharisees have the elder brother syndrome. And when Jesus is talking about those who are self-righteous, He also points this out in the parable of the prodigal son, where you have the one boy that left home, spent his money, came back to his father. The father received him joyfully, and the elder brother saying, "Why are you giving him a party?" And he stood outside the gate pouting and wouldn't go in to rejoice that what was lost was found. And the same thing happened in the book of Jonah, where Jonah goes and preaches to the people of Nineveh against his will. He doesn't want to go. He tries to run away from God. God gets him back on the right track, going to Nineveh. Jonah preaches the message and sits outside of the city waiting for God to destroy them. Just waiting for doom to happen. But then something happens Jonah didn't expect. The people of Nineveh repented. And then he gets mad that God is merciful. And he said, "God, I knew this was going to happen. I knew you were going to be merciful." Why? Why does he have this attitude? Why do both of these characters, Jonah being a real person, and then the parable of the prodigal son, the elder brother being the fictitious story, both of them have the same problem. They're all wrapped up in themselves. And they're all thinking very highly of themselves, and they're disdaining the one who is lost and needs to be found. And then the one that's lost is found, and then they get upset about it. That is the wrong attitude toward self, and it's certainly the wrong attitude toward the brother, and it's the wrong attitude toward God. So, how do we deal with the problem of pride and self-righteousness? First of all, I believe what we need to do is we need to have consideration.
for one another.
Consideration means that we should try to perceive something with our mind, that we need to think about something, that we need to ponder it, and we can consider the example of Jesus. In Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 1, the Hebrew writer says, "Therefore, holy brethren, partakers of the heavenly calling, consider the apostle and high priest of our confession, Jesus Christ." Why is the writer telling us to do that? Well, there's something about Jesus that needs to be considered. Number one, He is the Son of God. He has done something for us. He is our example. And He tells us in verse 2, "Look unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before Him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider Him who endured such hostility from sinners against Himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls." So here we are told exactly what it is that we need to do in Hebrews chapter 3 and in Hebrews chapter 12. That Jesus is our example. When Jesus is our example, it really gives us a high standard that we need to attain. Because we're not comparing ourselves to somebody that's flawed, you know, like the Pharisee did in his prayer. I think that I'm not like all these other men, the murderers and extortioners, and even as this tax collector. Well, you know, he might think he measures up pretty good if he compares himself to the right subject. But the author of Hebrews says you need to compare yourself to God. You need to compare yourself to Jesus. Look to Jesus. He is the one that endured hostility and yet without sin. Jesus did not quit serving His Father when others mistreated Him. The question for us is, what have we suffered compared to what Jesus endured? Have you ever known somebody that quit serving God because they felt like they were mistreated by their brethren? That happens all the time. I'm not saying they weren't mistreated by their brethren. They could have been mistreated by their brethren. It could have been that they were wearing their feelings on their sleeves, that they were too touchy. But it could have been that the brethren did some things they ought not to do, didn't have the right attitude toward them. So are we going to get mad at God when things don't go our way? Did Jesus quit serving His Father when others persecuted Him and said things against Him that were not true? The question is, what have we suffered compared to what Jesus endured, yet He was still faithful to His Father and His Father's mission for Him? We need to have that kind of attitude toward God, that we are not going to turn our back on Him regardless of what may occur. We need to consider one another. And when people are wrong, why do they blame God and turn to the devil? Really, the devil is the source of the problem in the first place. And when people are wrong, they will turn against the one that is on their side, the one that they should be aligned with, and turn to the one that caused the problem in the first place. And that really doesn't make sense. We need to consider one another and have the right attitude toward one another. And hopefully we can avoid those kind of issues coming into play. And that happens when we have the right love for God and the right love for one another. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 24 says, "Let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as is the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much more as you see the day approaching." When we come together, it's for our good. It should be to stir up love and good works. It should be so that we can hear the Word of God and we can be around those who share this common goal. And Hebrews tells us that even in that day, there were some that forsook the assembly, that they could have been there, but they weren't. And when I read this passage, I'm always reminded of Prince Anita Schott, who I know many times were, and those of you that don't go here regularly, the couple that passed away several years ago. But they were always here, and we always tried to see if we could beat the Schotts here. And Nobody ever could. The shots were always the first ones here. And it was the rare time that Ethan and Brendan would get excited because we actually beat the shots. But they were not in good health for a long time that I was here. But they never complained about it. You never heard them talking about and bad-mouthing their condition. They always had a good attitude and an attitude of wanting to help and do their part, and always the attitude of encouragement. They were both a great encouragement to me. And so when I read this passage and I think about all those who let other things get in the way when they really could be here, the shots, many times, I know, didn't really physically feel that great. But they came anyway. I know they did it because they loved all of us and they loved the Lord. And they wanted to be faithful to Him. And it certainly was an encouragement. Unfortunately, it's not always that way. And there are those that let other things get in the way of their service to God. But that's one way that we consider one another is when we come together. We ought to get something out of it when we are around each other. But we also need to think about the responsibility that we have to be here to encourage one another. Philippians chapter 2, verse 4 tells us not to look out only for his own interest, but also for the interest of others. And it certainly is implied here that people are already going to do that when it comes to themselves. It's implied that you're going to look out for your own interest, but here's what you need to do in addition to that. You need to look out for the interest of others. And in Romans chapter 15, verse 1, we're told that those who are strong ought to bear the scruples of weak, not to please ourselves. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 1 tells us, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. So each one of these passages, if you notice, they all talk about considering one another and the responsibility that we have toward one another. And we can't really do that unless we have a relationship with one another and spend time with one another. So consideration is a way to get away from the attitude of paying too much attention to self. Also, recognition is another word that comes into play. Recognition means to acknowledge the existence, to acknowledge the validity or the genuineness of a person or thing. So when it comes to recognition, number one, we need to recognize who God is. When we come together, we recognize God, and many times the men do a great job of that in prayer by starting out the prayer in recognition of who God is. He is our Creator. He's our Savior. He's the reason that we are together. The psalmist does a great job of this. Psalm chapter 8, verse 3 says, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the son of man that you visit him? You know, this kind of attitude is one that we should have when we go to God in prayer. It should be an attitude that we always have when we're thinking about God, that we recognize who He is and we recognize who we are. When we do that, self kind of takes the back seat, or should. When I consider His greatness, it really diminishes mine. And it begs the question, do I really consider and acknowledge God and the love and mercy that He has? Also, as Christians, we recognize the validity of others. James chapter 2 and verse 8 tells us that you need to fulfill the royal law according to the Scripture. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. You do well. The law is fulfilled in one word. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Galatians chapter 5, verse 14. But what happens if we are self-centered? Do we do that? Self-centered always look to their own feelings and not consider others. And sometimes those that are self-centered will complain about their feelings hurt, but no thought about what effect they're having on others. My dad was named Frank, and sometimes people said he was named that for a reason, because he would say what was on his mind. And he didn't always. You just don't have any idea what he didn't say. But he always said that he had a bad disease, and it wasn't contagious, but it was widespread, and he said it was hoof and mouth disease, that he always had his foot in his mouth, and it didn't sound good when he said it, but after he said it, he couldn't take it back, and there wasn't anything that he could do except apologize. But after it said, it couldn't be taken back. But he said, well, when he does that, he expects people to bear with him because they know he's got that problem. But when somebody else says it wrong, then we're all over him. And we expect people to bear with us when we make a mistake or we say something wrong or we make a joke that falls flat or whatever it may be. And we understand what our intent was. We understand that we didn't mean any harm. We understand it just came out wrong. So everybody understands why Randy said what he said and he really shouldn't have said it. But what about when somebody else says something? Am I going to jump all over that? You see that all the time in politics, and you're going to see it a lot in the next few months, where somebody will say something, and it won't come out right. It'll get played and played and played over and over and over, whether it was really the intent of that person or not. Selfishness and self-centeredness can cause us to have a really harsh attitude, not toward ourselves, but toward others. Which brings us to our next thought. How do we correct that? Well, love can correct that. Love, according to Vine, can only be known by the actions it prompts. God's love is seen in the gift of His Son. You know, when you have, I don't even know if they make them anymore because everything's gone electronic, but when I was growing up, baby dolls had the string on the back and you could pull it and it would say, I love you. Well, it didn't really give anybody goosebumps, I don't think, when the little baby said that, because it was just pre-programmed to do it. But when your real live son or daughter is growing up and the first time they tell you that they love you, you know, how does that make you feel? It made you feel a whole lot different than pulling a string on a baby doll, because it meant something. And love isn't just a word. It's known by the action that it prompts. Jesus said, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. And there's a lot of people that say that they love Jesus and they recognize that Jesus is the Son of God and they talk about love, but they don't really know what love is because it hasn't prompted any action in their life. Love, we can really see in God's attitude toward us because of what He did for us in sending His Son. 1 John chapter 4, verse 9 says, in this the love of God was manifested toward us, that God sent His only begotten Son into the world, that we might live through Him. And this is love, not that we love God, but that He loved us and sent His Son to be the propitiation for our sin. So we do see here that love is not the love of complacency. It was something that was actually a deliberate choice that God did for us. Husbands are told in Ephesians chapter 5 to love their wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave Himself for her. You know, if it had not been defined in this way, if it just said husbands love your wife, period, we would have just been able to define that however we wanted to and just say, oh honey, I love you. God told me I need to do that. But He didn't do that. Paul says, you need to love your wife just as Christ also loved the church. Well, that really brings up the standard, doesn't it? Because Jesus gave Himself to the church unselfishly, not thinking about Himself. And I don't think there's many husbands who can say they've never asked their wife to do something out of selfish reasons. That they always had their wife's best interests at heart. But we need to do what's best for our wives. Also, wives are told to love their husbands. And they should, in Titus chapter 2, verse 4, that they should admonish the young women to love their husband, to love their children. And when both parties are doing what it is that they ought to do, that relationship is going to work. But often selfishness gets in the way, and things aren't as they should. You know, the best description of love is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, in verse 4. Love suffers long and does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up. Love does not behave rudely. Love does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. Bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. love never fails, but when there are prophecies, they will fail. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it will vanish away. So when we analyze love, one of the things that we see here is that when it says love believes all things, is that we put the best possible construction on the words and actions of others. That we don't make false accusations and put the worst possible construction on others. Those of you that have been here a while may remember using this illustration before, but one of the congregations that we used to attend was North Shelby Church of Christ, and it was, before it's in their current location, it was in a shopping center. And it was in a strip center, and right next to the church was a liquor store. And so it just made it real convenient for everybody. But so if somebody saw me going through the building in the middle of the week to do something, if you didn't know me, well, there goes Randy into the liquor store. I see him walking right up toward it. When we talk about love, putting the best possible construction on something, somebody that loved me and knew me would not have assumed that, would have assumed the worst about me. They would have assumed the best. I see Randy go into the building in the middle of the week. He must be going to do something. They would not have assumed that I was going to visit the liquor store if they really loved me and knew me. But do we really apply that principle in our attitudes toward one another? When we see the actions and words of another, do we often put the worst possible construction and meaning on things? When we have an attitude of selfishness, we are not embodying these attitudes of love that we see in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Have you ever noticed that those who often accuse others of running the show, those who are the ones that people accuse of being control freaks, well, it's usually the control freak that is accusing the other person of being the control freak. That's usually what happens. It's the person that likes to take control of things doesn't like it when somebody else tries to take control of it. And they're not embodying that attitude of love. Love is an identifying mark of being a disciple. John chapter 13, verse 34 and 35, a new commandment I give you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this, all will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. And that love helps us to care for, to pay close attention, to be watchful, to look after, to provide for others. The illustration that many times that my father used in talking about this principle is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, that there should be no division in the body, that the members should have care for one another. If the member suffers, all the members suffer with it. If one member is honored, all the members rejoice with it. Now you are the body of Christ and members individually. So what does that mean? All the pieces of the body work together. If you are doing construction work, and you have a hammer and you have a nail, and you're trying to hit the nail, but you hit the wrong nail. You hit your fingernail. What happens? What happens is your hand comes and comforts the finger automatically, doesn't it? Everybody does that. The hand doesn't say, "You were in the wrong place. I knew that was going to happen to you. And I am not going to comfort you because you should have seen me." The hammer hits the wrong nail, gets no sympathy. You should have stayed out of the way. Well, that's not the way the body works. And 1 Corinthians chapter 12 talks about the body working together. But you see what I'm saying here? This is not always the way the spiritual body works. This is the way the spiritual body should work. But it doesn't always happen that way. There's not the sympathy and the love and all the parts working together as they should. Galatians, chapter 6, verse 10 says, "As we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially those who are of the household of faith." James chapter 1, verse 26 and 27 tells us that if you think you're religious and do not bridle your tongue, but you deceive your own heart, your religion is useless. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their trouble and keep oneself unspotted from the world. And so there are things as Christians that we are to look for to try to help. It may be different things for different people where they need encouragement or they need admonition. But when we care for one another, then the body is doing what it should. What I want you to see here is that when we have consideration and recognition and love and care for one another, you don't really see self anymore. But it's still there. It's just kind of hidden. It's just hidden. Denying self is putting God first. Jesus emptied Himself of self. And so that's the mind that we need to have. It's very sad to say, but I have seen in some places where people have made the comment about their congregation that the work of the church here, the work of Christ, is not going to prosper until we have the right funeral. What does that mean? I know it's a specific place where we used to live that was said, and it's a shame. But there was somebody that didn't embody these attitudes of consideration and being selfless, but they were selfish. And because they created such a stir and a bad attitude among the brethren, that it was very sad to say. Is the cause of Christ better because I'm here? Is the cause of Christ better because I live? Or would the cause of Christ just be better without me? Let's not have to answer that and say the cause of Christ would just be better if I weren't here. The elder son would not partake in the feast because of his selfishness. We have to crucify self. And Paul said in Galatians chapter 2 that that's what his life was about. He wasn't about his past accolades and thinking about everything that he could have done if he had stayed a Jewish leader. He said his life was about preaching Christ and Him crucified. And he had crucified himself. Because that's not what was important to him anymore. And we need to do the same thing. If you presented people with the question, would you give 1 year of faithful service to your job for a lifetime retirement? That sounds like being a senator or representative, doesn't it? But if you could get 1 year of service and you get a lifetime retirement, and it wouldn't destroy your health, but you just had to be totally committed to that work, would you do it? Well, most people would say yes. If I knew that I could be set for life if I just gave 1 year of totally committed service. But Jesus said, deny yourself, take up your cross daily, and follow me for one lifetime. But then we receive eternity. We receive that retirement that can't be matched. It really does make sense, doesn't it, to empty yourself. If you could just empty yourself for your lifetime, then you're going to be rewarded for eternity. It makes a lot of sense. It's too bad that many people are so wrapped up in self that they can't see what a great thing that is that God has done for us. So let's not be that way. Let's not be wrapped up in self. But let's be like Christ and live a life of being crucified with Christ. Have the right attitude toward God and toward ourselves and toward others. I hope these things will be useful to you. If we can help you in any way to be obedient to the gospel of Christ, we invite you to come while we stand together and sing.